This podcast is sponsored by JP Morgan Investment Trusts, offering innovative investment options for your stocks and shares ISA.
Hello, welcome to Citywire Funds Fanatic. My name is Gavin Lumsden, and I'm continuing our ISA season conversations with global investment trust managers. So I'm very pleased to introduce you to Andrew Bell, Chief Executive of Witten. Hello, Andrew. Thanks very much for making time to speak to me. Could you just start off by reminding everyone, what does Witten do? What do you do at Witten, and where do you get the name from?
Well, Witten, like an awful lot of the early investment trusts, doesn't really describe very adequately what we actually do. The name comes from an Anglo-Saxon word meaning a council of elders, a Witten Agamot, it used to be called. And I guess that the original board of directors thought of themselves as a council of elderly wise men and decided to call themselves after that. So we were set up in 1909 to manage the fortunes of one family. And what we do now is to manage the investments of many people around the country investing in global equities.
Okay. And the idea, and you're using a multi-manager approach. So that's picking up on this Witten
yes.
name in a way, doesn't it? You've got a collection of hopefully wise and skilled fund managers. You use eight of them in all to manage all to the assets. And the Witten had annual results recently, and they showed it's a difficult year, 2020,
yes.
for most investors. And but the results showed you had a strong rebound after a very difficult first half. So
yes.
That left the returns were positive, which was good. But how are you feeling about markets and prospects for stock markets now after the upheaval of 2020?
I'm feeling pretty positive, actually. I mean, not remotely complacent, because the market's a bit like a terrier. If you get complacent, it's going to bite you in the ankle. But we're watchful, but quite optimistic. And the reason is that clearly a lot of companies have adapted to the changes that were forced on us by COVID. So I think productivity by companies will have improved. And the vaccines are promising a route towards some normalization of economic and social life this year. And that's coming against the background where interest rates are at record low levels, and there's a massive amount of fiscal stimulus being applied worldwide. So it seems to us more than likely that might start at different points in different countries, but we're going to see a spurt in growth and probably quite rapid growth for the next 1 to 2 years, with a commitment to public investment, whether motivated by climate change or whatever. I think you need to be selective, because some parts of the markets ran very strongly last year and will have discounted the outlook. There are other parts of the market that still look pretty depressed and maybe hoping for the light to shine on them.
That's yes. And what are the main lessons? You've referred to the fact that there's an opportunity for businesses to work more efficiently. That immediately makes me think of online, the surge in online traffic and business.
Yes.
And just today we've heard Ocado, the online supermarket, reporting that sales are up 40% over a year ago. What do you think of the main long-term changes that are coming from the pandemic?
Well, to paraphrase Lenin, there are years when nothing happens and weeks when years happen. And 2020 certainly seems to have been catalyzed a dramatic acceleration of established trends, such as being able to work remotely, communicate with each other, home entertainment, shopping from home. We were faced with very little choice. So so you probably saw 2 or 3 years of acceleration in those trends. And obviously, on the other side of the coin, it was very difficult for anybody in the entertainment hospitality business to get any sort of traction at all. We've been told as companies for the last 10 or 20 years that you have to have business continuity plans in case your building blows up or terrorist attack, whatever it is. You had to show resilience, that you had a backstop plan. And I think one of the lessons for society is that countries are going to need to have business continuity plans in the way, for example, of having a redundancy in your healthcare systems. One of the main reason for closing countries was that there was an unacceptable burden of disease going around the country, and it was I think there's a there will be pressure in future to make sure that you have spare capacity to cope unexpected.
Right, so that sounds like, you know, more increased public expenditure, state expenditure, therefore higher taxes. I guess we've seen that in the recent budget here in the UK.
Definitely. I mean, I think the most governments appear to be devoted to trying to crank up growth before putting taxes up, and that's partly looking 10 years ago, but the unprecedented boost to public spending in the wake of the financial crisis was probably reversed too quickly. So the political mood now seems to be to get growth going and then subsequently sort out how we pay for it later.
Well, that brings us on to what the US Central Bank, the Federal Reserve, closely watched institution, because the US is the biggest economy, just about, still. It's mm-hmm. the biggest economy in the world. Yep. And it makes pivotal monthly decisions around interest rates. Its recent decision to forecast that the US economy is bouncing back nicely, forecasting 6.5% growth this year, mm-hmm. but also saying that it's minded to keep interest rates, US interest rates, you know, near zero for another 2 or 3 years, till 2024, in fact. Is the Fed doing the right thing there in just reassuring markets that interest rates are staying low, or is it just stoking inflationary fires?
I think they're balancing things about right at the moment. And there are two motivations for it. One is that a degree of reassurance is required, because after all the stops and starts of the last 12 months or so, recovery is still fragile, and it is vulnerable to setback if something happened to vaccination programs or the disease came back. So I think in the near term, it's very important to keep confidence, consumer confidence and business confidence, reassured and on the positive tack. If the economy overheats, they can cool it. I mean, that doesn't mean it will be painless, because if, you know, once inflation really does break out, the costs of getting on top of it, as we found back in the 1970s, can be quite considerable. But in the near term, the concern is to make sure that we have a proper, robust recovery in consumer spending and in business investment. But the other motivation for keeping interest rates low is less attractive from the, and it's something which officialdom will never admit to publicly, which is in past instances where you've had very high national debt, such as at the moment, have been followed by long periods when interest rates were kept below the inflation rate. And we seem to be in one of those periods now. It's otherwise known as financial repression. And effectively, it's bad for returns on bonds and cash, because money in the bank is being rewarded at less than the rate of inflation. But it's generally speaking supportive for economic growth and ultimately the value of real assets. I think it's inevitable that if you have too much debt, which we currently do, it's either going to have to be, it either won't be repaid, well, I think governments will repay, or else the value of what it's repaid in will have been debased. And I think that there's a message there for asset allocation.
Yes, so inflation is has been very low for a long time, but is coming back, it would seem. And in that context, one of the many things that got hit last year was dividends. But dividends are important. That investment income coming off equities is even more important when interest rates are so low, and perhaps inflation is coming back to erode the power of the spending power of people's money. Dividends are interesting with an investment trust like yourself. You're one of this band of dividend heroes. You've just declared another year of dividend rises, the 46th consecutive year, so well done. But actually, last year, you saw investment income basically halve as companies were cutting dividends in the UK and around the world because of the pandemic. You're able to do that, grow your dividend, even though that there's not the income there, because you've got reserves. Where could you just tell us where you think, how long are you able to continue doing that? And what are the prospects for dividends more broadly?
I think the first thing I'd say is that we're total return investors rather than dividend seekers per se. We're not sort of chasing after yield. But having a growing income from a portfolio is both a reality check that you have companies which are throwing off cash in the medium term. And also it's a measure of the growth that's spinning off from those companies. And over the last 46 years, as you say, we've compounded our dividend at quite a smart rate over time. But even though the total return on it's been a minority of the total return our shareholders have enjoyed, the reserves that we have after last year's drawing down of reserves are equivalent to about 1.25 times our annual dividend. And so they're available to support further, if we have some more years of shortfall in dividend income, which I think is possible for a few years. But we expect dividends to grow quite rapidly for this year and maybe next year as something of a bounce back from the exceptional cuts last year. It's almost without precedent to see substantial cuts in market dividends. And it's pretty much completely without precedent to see them spread across such a wide swathe of the market as we saw last year. So I'd expect to see some bounce back, both on the back of economic recovery and as companies that took precautions last year feel bolder, if you like, in 2021 and two. Longer term, our portfolio dividends have tended to grow at about 10 or 11% a year. And I think that's a sort of slightly more normal rate of growth. So what we anticipate is that over the coming years, our dividend cover, which was just under 60% last year, will steadily rebuild. And we expect to be able to continue growing our dividend at a more moderate pace than the 9% or so of the last decade as our cover rebuilds. And that's something that we've recently committed to. And so far, the signs are that dividend growth is starting to come back. The pulse is returning to the dividend beast in the early months of this year.
Yes, there have been companies reinstating their dividends, which has been great to see. Yes, sticking with the investment trust and what the results showed, you restructured the portfolio after changing the benchmark, the stock market benchmark you used to measure Witten's performance last year. And as a result, I think the weighting to the US has gone up. So you've increased. Have you increased the allocation to the US? Because it's standing at 35% at the moment.
We have effectively. I mean, a year ago, at the beginning of 2020, we moved from a benchmark which had 25% in the US to one that had approximately 50% in the US, and that was reflected what we felt that our shareholders wanted from us. They didn't want a big presence in the UK so much. They wanted to have something that was more of a participant in the opportunities from global growth. And a lot of the growth opportunities have happened to be concentrated in North America because of biotechnology and computing and so forth. So we moved to that benchmark, but we were a bit slow, as we've said in our reports to the market. We were too slow in making the adjustment. So we ended up chasing our tails a little bit in the early part of last year, that we had too little representation to the technology parts of the market that were seeing upgrades and too much representation in Europe and the UK, which were seeing downgrades. Whereas a year ago, that was down to how we'd allocated to different sorts of managers. Now, although we're underweight in the US with 35% against 49% of our benchmark, that's really down to the stock picks of our managers. If they felt neutral about the US, we'd be pretty well fully weighted in the US. And the reason that we have a lower weighting is, and we're not clairvoyant. So if we say that our benchmark's approximately 50% the US, it's reasonable for people to expect, something, if not close, but 5% would look ridiculous. And 95% would look ridiculous. So we're as underweight as we feel comfortable being. And the reason is we think there are some rapidly growing, or there are other markets which have got better recovery prospects this year. But on the other hand, there are some rapidly growing sectors in the US where you can't get the same exposure elsewhere. So we're led really by where our fund managers find the best companies. And my suspicion is that over time, our exposure to the US will grow. And it's not just the technology exposure that the US has. It's been quite impressive that on the monetary and the fiscal side, they've been much more aggressive in stimulating their economy than other countries. So we might well get a bigger growth surprise, as you alluded to earlier on from the Fed. The growth might well surprise more on the upside in the US than it does in Europe or possibly even the UK.
Yes, it's tricky, isn't it? So actually, you're actually significantly underweight the benchmark in terms of the US, even though you've got over a third of your assets in there. And is some of that caution because, or that underweight because you're a bit cautious about the all-time highs the US stock market has been reaching? But then, as you say, it has a record of bouncing back quickly from crises like this.
Yeah, I think it's not so much that. I mean, I think it's on a stock-by-stock basis that the overvaluation or the high valuation of the US market tends to be concentrated in some of the most fashionable areas of the last year in, you know, technology and internet services. And those, undoubtedly, many of them have great growth prospects. It's for debate whether those are, you know, too fully discounted and earnings need to catch up. But the reason that we're underweight in the US is not because our managers have thought we're going to be underweight in the US. They've found companies with better earnings prospects for the price in other markets, and as the world evolves, I suspect that will change. We're probably about as underweight as we're likely to be in the US, but that's partly also on risk management grounds. That if people buy us as a global fund, they're entitled to feel that the US is going to be, which is pretty much half, slightly more than half of the global index, that the US is going to be tend to be your biggest exposure. Otherwise, you're misdescribing yourself.
And does the same apply to the UK, but maybe in a kind of reverse way? Because you had a very difficult start to last year because, as you said, you were in the process of changing your benchmark, and that meant increasing the US, it meant reducing the UK. So I was kind of surprised in preparing for our conversation to see the UK is actually at 21%, so it's quite large. So you're probably long-term thinking of reducing that to fit in with the global index. But I was just wondering whether actually, you know, a year ago, slowly reducing the UK was the wrong thing to do because the UK then gets hit for six by the pandemic.
Yeah,
now, with the vaccinations going, it seems, relatively well, and we've got some more Brexit clarity, is the UK looking more attractive to your fund managers? Is that why? Is that an explanation for the 21%?
That is, in short, the explanation. I mean, yes, with the benefit of hindsight, we should have piled out of the UK as soon as the Brexit referendum happened and maybe gone back in December this year or, you know, the end, you know, 3 months ago. I think the point, I mean, just to clarify, we don't. Our benchmark is not the global index. It's 15% UK and 85% the global index. So if you look through those two, the UK is about 18% of our benchmark. So we are slightly overweight, but that's not a kind of deliberate thing. It's very much driven by our managers' choices. If our global managers were not overweight in the UK, we would be quite substantially underweight. We have one UK-only manager, which is Artemis, which handily beat the UK market last year and is doing so again this year. I think what's happening is that you had a combination of Brexit uncertainty. The UK economy is heavily dependent upon services, which were much worse hit by COVID. And the sector mix of the UK, not much tech, lots of oil and banks, was a major headwind last year. But it seems to us, and there seems more talk, it's perhaps in danger of becoming a bit of a consensus, but it's, you know, maybe not a danger yet. But that seems discounted. And we think that being in the UK has actually become a tailwind. But we suspect that we know that our managers are choosing companies for their specific attractions. And if those attractions move away, then they'll look elsewhere for markets. So we're not structurally overweight the UK. We're overweight through the choices and decisions of our various managers. And the other thing to say is that a lot of our UK exposure, a bit like that of the market as a whole, is in international companies such as Unilever, Diageo, Rolex, and so forth. We have relatively little, in fact, very little exposure to the oil sector, which is performing quite well at the moment. But we're happy with that because in the medium term, we think the oil sector is becoming obsolescent. And so we think there are better ways of playing the recovery.
JP Morgan Investment Trusts have taken the long view, delivering sustainable income and attractive growth through the market's ups and downs for almost 130 years. Find out how you can join us at jpmorgan.co.uk/longview.
In Europe, you replaced two of your fund managers there with global managers last year, and you got 15% allocated to Europe. And does that, which is less than the US and the UK, yes, obviously, does that feel like the right amount given the problems Europe is facing with the vaccinations, for example?
I think as an economic region, we see the UK to a lesser extent, perhaps, but Europe as a whole has tended to grow less rapidly than North America and obviously less rapidly than emerging economies. I think that's set to continue. And so as economies, we would want to be underinvested in Europe relative to the rest of the world. That's not the same as the stock markets, because there are a lot of very good global companies where the country of listing is of very little relevance to where they make their sales. So much of our exposure to Europe is in luxury goods and non-cyclical consumer goods. I mean, Heineken would be an example, Unilever, which obviously is a UK company, but, you know, sort of bilingual. It's where our managers see the attraction. I think, again, unlike a year ago, where we were structurally overweight, as in we had allocations that meant that if those allocations were filled to our European managers, we had, you know, we couldn't help but be overweight in Europe, which is not where we want to be longer term. Now we're overweight just by choice, that one or two of our managers particularly have taken a view that that Europe is a good area to find recovery stocks. And I think once that's moved on, and actually one or two of the growth managers have rifle shot some of the high growth stocks in Europe as well, some of the technology stocks. There aren't many, but they've found one or two of them. So it's, you know, we're stock pickers in Europe. We're not asset allocators to Europe.
Understood. And then last region or regions to look at in our sweep of the world, Asia and emerging markets. You've got two fund managers, it seems, working for you and doing very well there. Matthews in Asia and GQM in emerging markets. Mm-hmm. The fact sheet says you've got 13% in Asia. But emerging markets, where's that fit in? Is that part of other, which is only 1%? Or how much have you got in emerging markets?
No, I think, I mean, in emerging markets at the moment, we've actually got about, well, if you take Asia, we've got about just under 14%. And if you take emerging markets, excluding Asian emerging markets, we've got another 4. So the two combined are about 18% of our portfolio. And if you took them as a percentage of our benchmark, Asia Pacific and other global emerging markets are about 14. So we are overweight in those two areas combined, but they overlap because our GQG, in fact, it is our emerging markets manager has a substantial weighting in Asian emerging markets because those are seen as some of the more appealing ones, and even though some of them are, you know, quite well emerged, and in fact they have a fairly large proportion of our China exposure comes from GQG. We're overweight both of those categories. And the reasoning is that longer term, you're going to get faster nominal growth in those economies. Of course, that is not the same as saying that their markets are going to do as well. They're also exposed to the global economic cycle and also to sentiment on when dollar interest rates are going up. It tends to be a headwind for emerging markets. And we think at the moment that the cyclicals are aligned with the longer term growth availability, and also we're very attracted by the stock picking capabilities that of GQG in particular. So you know, we have been, you know, 4 or 5 years ago relatively lowly weighted in those areas, and over the last year or so it's benefited us to be relatively highly weighted in them.
So it sounds like that could be an amount that increases over time. I'm just curious, how, what about China? Where does China fit in? A lot of people seeing, you know, the long-term growth in China as being one of the really big themes in the world.
Yes.
How do you get your exposure there?
I think there are two things. One is the country of listing is not the same as country of exposure. There are quite a lot of, I mean, Unilever, for example, a very large proportion of the growth in Unilever's profits over the last 5 or 10 years has come from its exposure to emerging markets, even though it's a developed market stock. So we have at the moment about 5% of our portfolio in China, which is not a lot, but it's, you know, it's probably about a third of our exposure to Asia and emerging markets. longer term, it's a fairly good probability that China is going to become a larger part of the world economy and also a larger part of the world stock market. That's certainly a trend that's been in place over the last 10 years. And some of our global managers have positions in China. Some don't. But most of our exposure comes from our emerging market and Asia managers. And they're taking a stock-specific view, and there are some particularly the two themes that seem to latch onto it for China: the Chinese consumer and ways of playing that, which you can do from companies elsewhere, and some of the Chinese technology companies, which, despite the slight friction they've got with their own government at the moment, those have been seen near the Alibabas and Baidus and so forth of this world have erupted onto the world scene in the last decade or so. And there you're trying to trade off the growth prospects versus the internal and political governance of the country, where it's not a market where you can be completely confident that that market forces will be allowed to play out if it happens to disagree with the government at any particular point. So it's a growth honeypot, but you do have to mind your eye.
Absolutely. Okay, well, listen, thanks for that overview of sort of global asset allocation. Of course, you primarily work through choosing stock pickers. So should we have a closer look at some of the fund managers you've got? You've got eight, and we've mentioned a few already. Artemis, working on a UK special situations portfolio. And that's run by Derek Stewart, yes, who's a very well-known, very respected fund manager. And they've got Lindsall Train, running a global portfolio, one of several global portfolios you've got. So obviously that's run by Nick Train and Michael Lindsall. Yeah. I'm just wondering, there's some other well-known names there as well, or maybe a bit less well-known, but Andy Headley at Veritas and Peter Davies at Lansdowne. Yes. To what extent are you... I'm just interested to know a bit more about what they're running for you, because we know what these managers do, but are they offering something different to the retail funds that they're best known for? For example, Derek Stewart runs Artemis Special Situations. What kind of overlap is there between what he does for you and what you can get in his fund?
It's pretty complete. It's not absolutely 100%, but it's very similar, but cheaper. Because obviously we're allocating, $100 million or 200 million, or in some cases $300 or 400 million to managers, and you can get better terms than you would do if you're, an ordinary saver putting their annual ISA into a particular fund. You choose managers on the basis of what you think their aptitudes are, what their methodology is most best suited for, and to a degree their performance. Record, even though you healthy dose of skepticism about projecting it forward. So when we've chosen people, we thought, well, what's the point in telling them to do something that's 20% different from what we think that they're good at? So, but the portfolios, once we have them, and we don't hold the funds, we hold segregated mandates. So for a portfolio such as Lindsall Train, which tends to have very low turnover over time, their portfolio with us might well differ in exact weightings with their open-ended fund, because the open-ended fund can rebalance in accordance with flows in and out as time goes by. But essentially, we're buying something similar to what they do for other similar clients, whether that's some cases retail clients, some cases they don't have funds for retail clients. But generally speaking, we think we get economies of scale.
Well, maybe okay, I could come back to that. But I was just wondering, in terms of fund managers, that's one of the kind of critical questions is how long, you pick them because you think they're good and they've been good in the past, but there might come a time when they're not doing so well. How long do you give an underperforming fund manager before you intervene and take the mandate away from them?
I mean, there isn't a fixed answer to that. And the most obvious reason is that you can't change past performance, whether it's good or bad. So I think the point is very clearly when performance is particularly good or particularly bad, you should be alert as to whether it's going to be extrapolated, and you should refresh your view as to whether you have confidence in that manager for the future. And that might involve adding money to somebody on weakness. It might involve trimming a position if somebody's done very well, or it might involve completely changing your view. But it's your view of the future, not your view of the past, that's useful.
Okay. And how do you balance, managers have different styles and different approaches, obviously, and there's a lot of debate now between the two competing styles of value versus growth.
Yes.
Growth having dominated, but value coming back with a vengeance since November.
Yeah.
What is your view on this style debate? It's not a new one,
yeah,
but
absolutely.
What's your view?
No, I think people have different definitions of what they mean by value. And in some cases, the sort of systematic value is we want to buy companies on the cheapest companies on a price to book basis or on a PE basis or whatever, on the assumption that they will bounce back and that that's a style that's been badly punished over the last 10 years or so, partly because we've had a very long period of relatively anemic growth when there wasn't a big enough cyclical bounce to get poorly managed companies out of trouble. So the sort of the mean reversion recovery story proved to be the crock of gold at the end of the rainbow. You could never get there. So what we want to do is to buy the future growth in companies more cheaply than it's worth. And obviously you'll be willing to pay more for a company that's going to grow at 15 or 20%. The one that's in a dependable industry that's growing at 6 or 7. So we're not allergic to paying high valuations for companies where we think the prospects are there. Where we're more skeptical, and this was where a year ago we felt that the pandemic catalyzed this. It underlined the prospect that the future was going to be was not going to be the same as the past had been for many very cheap companies. So what we're trying to do actually is to buy managers with perhaps a bit of an inkling towards growth, but to be broadly speaking, stylistically fairly neutral in the round, and where their stock picking is more important than which part of the value growth church they happen to inhabit.
All of this is being done against the context of, the massive challenge from climate change.
Yes.
And I just wanted to ask you about another one of your interesting fund managers or investments is in a fund called GMO Climate Change.
Yes.
I think that you are investing in the fund there rather than having your own pot of money being managed.
Yes. I mean, the reason is it's twofold. One, as an early founder in that fund, we got a concessionary fee. But the other thing is that when we initially invested, it was less than a 1% position, but it had 140 holdings within it, and we thought dividing a 1% holding in our portfolio 140 ways would have been very messy. So we've stuck with it as a fund investment. It's run, the GMO is a US-based company called Grantham Mayo Van Otterlo, and Jeremy Grantham, who was one of the founders of it as a value management house. Historically, they made their reputation managing portfolios for institutions and so forth with a value bias. But he has also become quite a big name in the climate change debate. And he's quite interesting. You find a couple of, look on the internet for some interviews with him. He's quite, he's quite passionate about it. And he presented to our board 2 or 3 years ago, on the back of which we decided to, we didn't actually know he had a fund when we invited him to present. For all the obvious reasons, his view was rather than doing something purely for ethical reasons, if this is something we are all going to have to do as a world to mitigate the effects of climate change, it should be a business opportunity. So if you have a portfolio that is positioned to buy companies which will mitigate or counteract or benefit from the necessary changes, that should be a good investment decision as well as a good decision for the planet and its people. And so we decided to. But he said also the thing is when something becomes fashionable, the valuations can get overhyped. So you can find if you were so the value discipline they have means that they tend to reduce the weightings in areas that get particularly overheated in favour of other parts within the climate change portfolio that are slightly more neglected. And so it can't exclude, but it can mitigate the risk of being in an area which, as we can see at the moment, is seeing a lot of fashionable fund flows. But we see this as the direction where a lot of portfolios are going to go. But we wanted both to make a statement also, but also to benefit from a concentrated portfolio with that as its main theme. And some of their holdings are, you know, in industrial companies and mining companies on the basis that, you know, if you want to electrify the economy, you're going to need a lot more copper.
Oh, that brings me on to another topic, because GMO climate change has done very well for you last year. I think returns are over 30%, if I remember correctly. But I was going to ask you about another part of your portfolio where you invest directly in stocks and funds, mm-hmm. And quite often take advantage of value opportunities in other investment trusts.
Yes.
So you've got a stake in for a while in BlackRock World Mining, which also came good for you last year. I just wondered whether there was a sort of tension there with the kind of climate change and environmental sensibilities of GMO.
Yep.
But I think you're going to tell me that there are environmental drivers for a lot of the specialist mined metals.
Yes, I mean, there's a debate to be held, clearly, because not every miner can justify its existence because it's helping to mitigate climate change. And some of them have had, they operate in a very difficult industry and people, do become injured, and there's pollution, and there are bad things about it. So one of the things, as we were just mentioning, that we're going to need a lot more copper to electrify the transport and the transport industry, for example. You need far more copper for an electric car than you do for an internal combustion engine car. So there's that benefit. BlackRock, as a manager, have a very active ESG engagement with process. They're one of the sort of leading major institutional developers of best practice in that area, and they actively engage with companies. I mean, one of which was Rio Tinto a couple of years ago, where the company overruled local objections and damaged some Aboriginal sites in Australia. I'm not privy to all of the details of how they engage with the companies, but that and Norilsk Nickel, where they had the spill in the arc. The point is, if we can't do without mining, what you need is to engage with companies so that they are held to account when they behave badly or whether by accident or deliberately, and that they're encouraged to improve and do whatever they do as cleanly as possible. And if no institutions invested with big companies, there would be nobody there to put pressure on them to change. So we see it as we see BlackRock World Mining our mining exposure as something which is a cyclical play from our point of view. We bought into it about 6 years ago, which was too early because it was just before the oil price collapsed, and we kept on buying into the downturn, and it's turned out to be an extremely profitable position for us because our position cost us less than £2 a share, and the shares are now £6 and have paid 20p a year dividend or so in the meantime.
Another one of the sort of discounted opportunities that you've bought into on the investment trust is Schroder Real Estate Investment Trust. Yeah, we're interested in that one because that's had a tough year and the shares are still at a wide discount. What's your view of that real estate investment trust and its sector generally? Mm-hmm. Obviously, the office sector and retail sector have been profoundly hit affected by the pandemic and the lockdowns. Where do you see the recovery coming, if at all?
Before the oncoming train of the pandemic hit us, it was affected by Brexit sentiment. And, that was what the opportunity we originally took to become invested. Our first investment was somewhere over 50p a share. They're now about 40p. But it was a 5% discount to the then prevailing price. So it was, you know, in retrospect, we could have waited. But the point was that it's a company that we invested in about 10 years ago as well, and did quite well out of. And the differentiating factor is that they're not really a mainstream play on London offices or retail parks. They have some exposure, but their main skew has been to try and get involved with more rapidly growing cities, where slightly more specialised industrial parks might have less specific tenant risk and potentially more scope to upgrade the property and get better rental out of them. But it's a relatively small position for us. It's under 1%. My own belief is that once we get back to some sort of normal economic life, people will start assessing property companies on what the actual numbers are, rather than a broad brush. They've got office exposure. Offices are a dinosaur, so we don't want to be involved. People will start to look at the specifics. And this particular company, we think, has got a reasonably on their own projections of the dividend they expect to pay. They have a yield of around about 6%, which now looks to have found a base and be growing. And they're buying back shares quite actively in the 40-41p a share range against an NAV in the upper 50s. So they're doing the right things. And I think in due course, a combination of buying back shares and rehabilitation as people come to believe in the restored dividend will lead some of the investors who jumped ship a year ago when they dropped the dividend to look back at them again. So we think it's a cyclical play that's cheaper than it needs to be at the moment.
Well, near at the end of our time, Andrew, but I'm just you're referring there to sort of potential normalisation of life, getting back to normal life, whatever that is, and the office sector. Just on a sort of personal note, so we're beginning to talk about at Citywire at the office reopening possibly in June, mm-hmm. and how much time are we going to spend back in the office and how that's all going to work. What's your situation? Have you been working at home presumably all these months?
Yes, we have. Business continuity plan, which historically used to be if your building catches fire, then you've got an office somewhere in South London or Canary Wharf that you can go to. In 2018, we decided we're a small enough number of people that the better thing was for us to work from home. And so we equipped everybody with computer equipment to be able to work from home. So from about, I think, March the 16th last year, we've worked continuously from home. Personally, I'm probably going to start going back to the office relatively occasionally next month, and less occasionally from May or June onwards. And thereafter, it's going to be in accordance with both the individual comfort of my own colleagues and also what the government guidelines are.
Absolutely. Well, that all makes a lot of sense, Andrew. Well, good luck with that transition, and let's hope we can all get back to whatever the normality we like in due course. But in the meantime, thanks very much for joining me and sharing me your thoughts. We covered a lot of ground, and I think it's been very useful. So, good luck with the rest of the year, and thanks for talking to me today.
Look forward to actually meeting you in person again.
Absolutely, in real life. All right, take care, Andrew.
Take the long view on your stocks and shares ISA with JP Morgan Investment Trusts.